Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guests are founding partner of GBO Strategies and polling expert Jim Gerstein, and the U.S. national editor and columnist at the Financial Times, Ed Luce. Now remember, we love taking your questions, so write to politicswarroom@gmail.com for next week's show. Now I'm going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. You can also get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. So tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And please check out the link to our sponsor, Superpower, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting the sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. James, after Saturday night shooting at the correspondents' dinner, Donald Trump, also after the visit of King Charles this week, which we'll discuss later, Trump could have lowered the temperature a little. He did for a nanosecond, and then he and his lackeys went on a terrorist-like rage. Trump blamed the Democratic rhetoric for encouraging violence. Let's roll the tape. Trump called for executing General Mark Milley, who was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He said Democrats were scum, and he hated them. He said former President Joe Biden, after he was diagnosed with cancer, he called him a decrepit corpse. When former FBI director and special counsel Robert Mueller died, Trump said, good, it was cause for celebration. When it comes to language that incites hate and violence, Trump is in a league of his own. Then his lapdogs lapped into further incite and decimate the rule of law. Acting Attorney General Cut Todd Blanche, always auditioning to keep his post, unlike his predecessor, Pam Bondi, he went and he indicted. He indicted former FBI Director James Comey at Trump's instructions. Now, let's just think for a minute about what he indicted him for. He indicted him in North Carolina. An earlier indictment had been thrown out. Came back again, and for taking a picture of seashells on a beach that spelled out 8647. I didn't know this before, but 86 is a restaurant phrase for getting out or running out. Trump is the 47th president. But Blanche and his crony, Kash Patel, incredibly charged that this was a threat by Comey to kill the president. Nobody believes that. I just happened to ask four or five people at random what 86 meant. They looked at me like I was crazy. One said, well, it's between 87 and 85. This indictment is an embarrassment to the rule of law and the First Amendment. It will be thrown out. Then lapdog number two, Brendan Carr, said he would review Disney's ABC-owned stations because comedian Jimmy Kimmel on ABC told a joke that Trump didn't like. Even Ted Cruz said that was improper and wrong. You know, James, just this is worse than the McCarthy era in many ways, because Blanche, Carr, and Patel are doing what you might expect, really, in Germany in the 30s, the Soviet Union and Russia today, not in America. It's what they are all about.
Well, all right. First of all, they're assholes, which is bad. And they're buffoons, which in its own way is good. I cannot tell people that listen to the show loudly and clearly enough, you just hang in there to November. I think this thing is growing by the day. I'm looking at polling in the middle of the country that is just jaw-dropping. And there's nothing, you can't stop an asshole from being an asshole. That's just who they are. The whole lot of them. And, any thought that he would have any sense of graciousness. And I would also, just as a side thing, if King Charles ran for president against Donald Trump, King Charles would get 57.5%. Country's done with this guy.
Did you say 57.5%? I might take that up to the 60s.
It might. That's what we got to understand. They're just done with him. And I've never been up. I don't care about the English monarchy. I like going there and watching it. He seemed like an okay guy to me. I never thought about him that much, but he's gone up. He and Pope Leo might be the two greatest people on the planet Earth right now.
Well, we'll get to him with Ed Luce later, but you're absolutely right.
Right. No, he stepped up to it. See, and so just, he's going to keep doing these kinds of things. And then go ahead, man, have all the fun you can, because this party is going to be over come November.
Yeah. You know, later in the week, Republicans on the Supreme Court, again, paid obedience to their party's political interest by further gutting the Voting Rights Act and overturning a congressional map in your state of Louisiana, where two of the six House members are Black. That reflects a state that is one-third Black. But Sam Alito and his fellow Republicans really want to gut the entire Voting Rights Act, as Justice Kagan in dissent said. So they threw out that map, and I think the result's probably going to be, you'll know better than I do, there'll be only one Black congressman in your state, which has 33% Black, and it's a pattern other states will follow because that's what the Supreme Court wants.
So it's more complicated once you drill down on it than you think. So let's just talk about Louisiana, because you have the potential redistricting. You have two Black congressmen, one Cleo Fields, one Troy Carter. Cleo is Baton Rouge-based. Troy was the original Black district. It was more New Orleans-based. Cleo has better relationships with the Republicans in Baton Rouge by far than Troy does. So if they could redistrict it down to one seat, which one survives? Or will they try to redistrict it down to no seats? The Supreme Court would have no problem with the Republican legislature in Louisiana drawing a 6-0 map in a state that's right. One-third Black. Right? So May is a huge month for the Republican Party. We have the Louisiana Senate race. We have the Julia Letlow, who is the Landry Trump-endorsed candidate against incumbent Bill Cassidy, and the insurgent right-winger John Fleming, who I've talked to a bunch of people before the show to try to get better informed. And there's not a lot of reliable polling. So but everybody's kind of, I could see any one of the three, two of the three making the runoff is the best information I can get. Now, layered on top of that, you have the special for the Massey seat in Kentucky primary. And then you have, I think, 5 or 6 state Senate Republicans in Indiana who defied Trump a primary. At the end of May, we're going to know a lot more about Trump's standing in the Republican Party, because these are three deep red states.
Boy, they sure
that
are.
Trump has got bill of the politics, and pay attention here. This is a real bell for the fall. The Louisiana, Kentucky, and Indiana primaries are way, way more meaningful than people think. And I to be honest with you, Al, I don't have a good poll to where they are or where Massey is or where it is in Louisiana. I don't have any inside information, but we're going to know a lot more. And if this goes the wrong way for Trump, it's going to set off a stampede.
Because it's the fear factor. And, you know, if he can't deliver, if Massey wins and 4 or 5 of those Indiana state senators win and that woman doesn't win in Louisiana, the fear factor dissipates a bit.
Yeah, and I want to be clear. I'm not predicting one thing or another. I was in the middle of making my phone calls back to Louisiana, but it's amazing how at least from the political class in Louisiana, both Republican and Democrat, I could see any scenario happening right now. Boy, if Letlow doesn't make the runoff, which I'm not saying that she won't, but if she doesn't, I'm told about people in Baton Rouge, you can just feel Jeff Landry's power just ebbing away. You can just watch it right in front of you. And if Trump
God,
loses,
that'll break your heart, James. That'll just break your heart.
But as you
maybe
know,
you get a new football coach and a new AD and a new basketball coach.
Yeah, let's just see if this guy we got, let's stick with him for now. But you've covered politics long enough to know when a president loses his political juice, he loses his power, or she loses her power, whichever the case may be. And let's see what happens. I don't want to anticipate something that I don't know the answer to.
Right. Lyndon Johnson used to say if he lost the vote in Congress, that the sharks would be in the water. Now, I don't think it's quite that much today, but I think the point is exactly what you just made. Final word on Todd Blanche, who's occupying an office that was held by Robert F. Kennedy, Elliot Richardson, Ed Levy, and Robert Jackson, and he is disgracing that office. You know, as an aside, James, he's trying to get in the Metropolitan Club to join some distinguished members. Now, I have no interest in getting the Metropolitan Club at all, so I don't want to belong to any club that would take me. But I can understand why objections have been raised to his application. Whatever you think of the Metropolitan Club, it's easy to see why the likes of Todd Blanche would not be welcome by most members.
So I don't know Todd Blanche or any of them. And maybe just because the guy looks normal or he can speak English, he seems like he's having like more ability than Pam Bondi or, you know, the labor secretary or the general idiot. But maybe he doesn't. But he is acting like a complete lackey and a complete fool.
I think that's what he is. I agree.
One day. I don't know that. I mean, there's some right-wing conservative lawyers that are very good lawyers that are very thought of in the legal community. And but my sense is at one time, Todd Blanche was one of those, but he no longer is. But I don't know that.
Well, he was in the top tier, but he was probably second tier, and now he's down around fourth or fifth tier. And it's even people who used to like him and work with him say he's really, a guy on CNN.
But he was a lawyer. He was a real lawyer. Real clients and did real things.
Yeah. He really has brought disgrace to the office of Attorney General, even though he's acting Attorney General. James, a final thing. I want to point our listeners, our viewers, to a really good article in The New Yorker by Ruth Marcus on pardons. It's a long, long article. She's done great reporting on pardons in this administration. They have taken pay to play to a new level. If you've done something bad, if you're corrupt, if you're in jail, if you want to pay, whatever the sum, oftentimes it's seven figures, and go to the right people like Roger Stone, you're going to get a pardon. That's exactly. The founders basically vested maybe only one power, very few powers, solely in the president. We really believed in separation of powers, as King Charles says, but the power of the pardon was vested solely in the president. No one thinking it would be abused like this. But right now, he has pardoned drug dealers. He has pardoned total criminals. He has just pardoned awful people. And it's almost always pay to play. Read the Ruth Marcus piece in The New Yorker.
You know, I've known Ruth Marcus for a long time. I haven't been in contact with her for some time. You probably know her better. But she's a really serious person. Isn't she like a kind of accomplished lawyer? And I mean, I think she went to some really good law school. She's a very talented person.
I think she did. I know Linda Greenhouse, right. I think, went to Yale Law School.
I know
and
really
maybe
Linda
Ruth did too.
I know Linda, she did. But I shouldn't be saying that, but I've always known Ruth to be a very polite, person, but very talented. And if she wrote it, she said it, I believe it.
Well, you guys get out there. You guys get the New Yorker on pardons, pay to play. It's as corrupt as anything we've seen. That really goes a long way. Hey, James, if you're interested in American politics, a great place to turn is Ed Luce, the chief columnist for the Financial Times, chief U.S. columnist. Now, if you want to find out about what's going on across the pond, a great place to turn is Ed Luce. So that covers a lot of territory, and he is our guest today. Ed, we'll get to the significance of King Charles's visit, but first, just let me give you a quick thought. I used to think of him as a bit of a stiff. But I got to tell you, I was really impressed, particularly by his speech to the joint session. He spoke about the importance of Ukraine, climate change, the centrality of separation of powers in our system, a subtle slap at Trump, the U.S.-Great Britain relationships. He even had some humor. At 1776, paraphrasing Dickens, was the tale of the two Georges. You wrote before that he had a delicate line to walk. My impression is he walked it pretty darn well.
Yeah, I mean, a lot better than I expected. I mean, he has, through phases of his life, been fairly lugubrious, a bit of an Eeyore, not particularly known for his sense of humor, at least in public. But I thought his comic timing and the turns of phrase, both in his address to Congress and in his speech at the banquet, the state banquet that evening, were really well delivered, and I think written by him. But the the surreal quality, the Lewis Carroll quality to this is what really sort of took me, that you'd have a descendant of George III giving a history lesson on how the origins of checks and balances come from the Magna Carta through the Glorious Revolution, and getting both parties, but particularly the Republican Party and the Vice President and the Speaker of the House behind him, onto their feet in applause about checks on executive power. You know, that was a down the rabbit hole moment for me. I just was not expecting that.
Oh, I thought it was a really important inclusion. From what I could tell, the Democrats rose first, and I think that having occurred, Johnson and Vance had no choice. Either that or they didn't understand what he was saying, but it was a really, really good moment. Look, there's tension between the two countries, not the first time. The two leaders, Trump and Starmer, don't seem to be particularly fond of one another. Can the king, he's the head of state, but he's not the head of government, he's not involved in policy, can he in this trip make any difference?
You know, I doubt it. I'd like to say yes, because it was such a sort of memorable occasion, the DC leg of the state visit, but I very much doubt it. If you look at the guest list for that state dinner banquet at the White House, it was, the only journalists there were Fox News anchors.
Yep.
And the only media executives were Rupert Murdoch employees.
Were there any Democrats there? I looked at it quickly.
No Democrats. No sort of prominent British Americans.
Or Rosarians.
Nobody outside the sort of Silicon Valley bro circles. It was clearly a guest list designed to by Trump, and he was in charge of it. Remember, he is his own social secretary at the White House. He, right. British Embassy lost control of the guest list, and he was clearly tailored to his friends, his world, seeing that he hobnobs with a monarch. It was an ego thing. That guest list reflects ego, not bilateral relations, not the alleged special relationship, certainly not geopolitics, not big business ties. I mean, except with the Silicon Valley, some of them are invested in Britain. But no, I'd love to say that his schooling in the importance of Ukraine and Article 5 of NATO, and then of the softer powers of interfaith tolerance, the need to tackle the melting polar caps. I'd love to think that he shifted the needle, but I think it would be naive to conclude that.
Yeah, I fear you're right. You know, much of the difficulties today centers on Trump's reckless war in Iran. The Brits learned a quarter century ago, it's a mistake to follow an ill-advised American war. It's going to cause you trouble. And it strikes me that there's no way that the real tension is going to be significantly eased or back to what we hope it'll be, if possible, until Trump gets out.
I think that's correct. I mean, the flattery's been laid on thick by Britain, by Keir Starmer, and then by Trump's state visit to Britain. Remember, the only president to have had two, and his stay at Windsor Castle, last September, but it didn't have any impact on Trump's irritation, right, you know, with NATO, and then more latterly, you know, bringing things like Diego Garcia, the British base in the Indian Ocean, into play with his extreme irritation over Starmer's refusal to support Operation Epic Fury. The real point here is that if Starmer had supported Operation Epic Fury, he would already be out of office. It is so unpopular, not just in Britain, but across every other ally, and indeed the American public, that there's no way even allies of Trump, like Giorgia Meloni, can support Operation Epic Fury. It is seen, I think, correctly, right, as a blunder.
You know, it's so good to have you elevate. James and I thought Diego Garcia was a defense person for Manchester United, but it's good to know. It's good to have someone here who understands these big issues. We're going to return to your native country in a minute, but you warned us in a column the other day. I'm an Ed Luce reader of every column. I would anyway, but it's primarily due to your wife, so let's thank her. But you've warned to get ready for a long war. But I think Trump's going to find some way to get out of this sooner.
I've no doubt that Trump will find some kind of off-ramp before he meets Xi Jinping in Beijing 2 weeks from now. At the summit he's been craving since he was reelected. He's been soliciting this even more than a royal visit. That's the status sort of ego snack. Xi Jinping is the power ego snack. So that's a visit to the emperor, and Trump's been craving that. Not a word of criticism of China and of Xi Jinping has come out of Trump's mouth since he was reelected. Even Putin, he criticizes occasionally in sort of bipolar sweeps before he returns to not criticizing Putin. Xi Jinping stands alone as being the one world leader he has not criticized. He doesn't want to postpone that summit again. He's postponed it once because of the Iran war. He doesn't want to postpone it twice, but the off-ramp will not end the war. It will just pause it. There's no way Iran is going to give over 420 kilograms of enriched uranium, or it's 11 tons of non-enriched uranium. Possession is 9/10 of the law. It is its key piece of leverage, in addition to its ability to close and open the Strait of Hormuz. And it is in an existential place in its own mind. And the fact that Trump goes from, you know, veers from promising heaven to threatening hell, often within the same day, does not enhance his negotiating credibility. So Trump can choose an off-ramp, but most of them lead straight back onto the highway. And the markets in particular are way too complacent about how quickly this situation can be wrapped up.
Right. James Carville.
So, Ed, I'm going to take a little bit of an issue about the king. And what I think is something really fascinating is that two ancient institutions that we kind of thought had their past due date. One is the British monarchy, and the other is the papacy. It seems to me that the king and the pope might be a little more relevant and a little more paid attention to than we would have thought 5, 10, 15, 20, 50 years ago. And my understanding is that they're having some kind of a meeting coming up. And I actually think that these two representatives of two undemocratic, monarchical, white privileged organizations are actually rising a little bit in influence in the world. Am I crazy?
You're not. I think it's a really interesting thought that obviously, you know, Charles's coronation was not rigged because, you know, it was an accident of birth. But Trump and people around Trump, including Steve Bannon, thought that the conclave that elected Pope Leo the 14th was rigged because he's only a Chicago liberal in their eyes, but you know, a White Sox supporter. I mean, what could be worse? Right. I think that there is a real move in public opinion, our technology viewing habits, towards judging authenticity. And although these are very elite sort of figures, an ancient and almost sort of useless ones in terms of real world executive power, they are actually quite sincere characters.
Right.
Pope Leo and King Charles. You know, they don't need to pander because they don't need to seek re-election. Right. And so I think there is something to the comparison you make, James.
So this is kind of amazing that I think, and this is my own view, is the world becomes more disorderly and becomes more unpredictable. There's some of us, even like, you know, what I would call liberals, that sort of want to inch back a little bit toward order and tradition, not the other things that have brought, but that there's some moral voices. I want to ask you a question about the king. You know, I grew up, we were roughly the same age, and he was always looked like the guy that was just sitting around waiting, and the mother was refused to die. And he's exhibited some talent. Did people see this before he became king, that he would have this kind of talent, to say ability to walk a diplomatic line, to like have more influence than we thought of, or was, I never thought about the guy much, to tell you the truth, but he does seem to be a person of some intelligence and creativity and political understanding. Did you see this coming?
So he has been, I mean, what he would best be known for is A, the whole Diana, you know, scandals, controversy, never falling in love. And then more in Britain, his sort of campaign for various things like, I don't know, organic food. And I mean, even at one point, he was reputed to be talking to his plants. And he had this thing about modern architecture. He said, modern architects have done more damage to London than the Luftwaffe.
He might have right. Go ahead.
So he was seen as conservative, small c, and rather eccentric, but mostly just impatient to be king and aware that his mother had longevity on her side. And so not particularly beloved at all. And I'm not sure he's beloved now, but he has, as king, surprised on the upside by just how well he has chosen words and treated big occasions. And, you know, he makes addresses that don't veer too political in the British context, but that do stress things like interfaith tolerance, right, and comfort with, you know, diversity that, you know, I suppose some could see as political, but he keeps it sufficiently nuanced for it not to trigger hatred by the right. I think that might still happen. There might be a right-wing sort of small-R republicanism in Britain that has yet to show its head. I mean, Rupert Murdoch hates the monarchy, and it wouldn't take much to sort of switch the sun, you know, in an anti-monarchical direction.
So all my political life, I've grown up to the extent I knew anything about British politics, it was Labour, and there was the Tories, and, you know, Churchill, Clement Attlee, Macmillan, you name them, Tony Blair. The Tories got wiped out in the last election. I mean, like, really wiped out. And Keir Starmer is, like, historically unpopular. I mean, like, I don't know. What? When do they have to call an election by? And what the hell? I mean, what's going to be? Where's the power center going to be after this election? Oh, but it looks like to me the two parties that everybody grew up with are in serious disrepute over that.
Yeah, they are. It's a genuine concern, and there's no new equilibrium in sight. There's a restlessness to the electorate that could mean they'd one day vote for the Reform Party, the sort of nativist Reform Party, and the next vote for the Greens. Anything to sort of, whatever the nearest middle finger is, they'll sort of, they're in the mood to grab it. And there's no necessary ideological coherence to this feeling of anti-politics, this frustration with the system not really delivering. And you've got similar stories in countries like France and Germany. The two main parties in Germany, the Social Democrats, Christian Democrats, they used to take up to 90% of the vote between them. I think it's now sort of roughly half the vote between them. I mean, and that's really the same trend in Britain So there's a restlessness that isn't necessarily about the march of the populist right solely. It's also march of anti-politics parties on the left of various. There is a sort of unpredictability and a volatility that I can't see the end of at the moment, particularly when you've got low growth.
Thank you. Al Grash.
Well, I was going to say the other thing I think I would give Charles credit for is cashiering his sleazy brother, Prince Andrew. And that, you know, when we talk about the British-U.S. problems, how much, Ed, was it caused by Starmer's stupid appointment of a Jeffrey Epstein crony, Peter Mandelson, as ambassador to Washington?
Yeah, that wasn't a smart decision. And I think what occasioned it, what really the reason why Starmer wanted to bring Mandelson back was because he associated Mandelson, I think fairly, with Third Way, with Blairism, with New Labour and the great successes of that period, because he doesn't have his own updated version of Blairism. Starmer doesn't really have a theory of the case. There's no coherence to what he wants to do. And if you ask 10 Brits what Starmer want to achieve, you'll get 15 different answers, all of them wrong. Yeah. There is no Starmerism. And so Mandelson was, I think, you know, it was a bring back the Beatles, get the Beatles together again. And given the fact the guy has twice before had to resign from British governments, including Blair's, over sleaze, this really was sort of a cardinal error. And there are very good British diplomats around.
Well, how about the ambassador who's here now? What's your assessment?
I think he's really good. He's top. Christian Turner is his name. He was top of the Foreign Office. He had an interesting time as ambassador or high commissioner, as we call it, to Pakistan. One of his last jobs, but two or three, where he really transformed UK-Pakistani relations. Britain needed things like better counterterrorism cooperation from Pakistan, and it wasn't getting it. And so he single-handedly organized a lifting of the boycott of England touring Pakistan to play cricket, which is a religion there. And he didn't actually tell the English cricketers, so they were quite pissed off about this, but they had to spend 3 months playing cricket in Pakistan, and that lifted the global ban on other countries playing cricket in Pakistan. So it bought him everything he wanted in return from the Pakistanis, and he became a celebrity, spoke good Urdu, would appear in the commentary box, you know, for cricket game, international cricket games. So that's real diplomacy. You know, Washington's a different place, but I think he's a top diplomat.
Yeah, there'll be lots of challenges. Let me ask you one more question, then I'll turn it back to James to close. Ukraine, where's it heading?
There's going to be a Russian counteroffensive at some point. There always is. There's always a summer counteroffensive. But the way their late winter and spring offensives have gone, which is not very well, they've really not gained much ground. And the Ukrainians keep out-innovating them in terms of battlefield technology. I think means that all the things Putin a month or two ago might have thought were windfalls from the Iran war, namely the extra oil revenues, are not necessarily going to translate into anything if he's really beginning to scrape the barrel in terms of recruiting troops. Recruiting fresh soldiers to replace the 30,000 or so casualties every month. So I think it's looking pretty good for Ukraine. And just one other thing, Orbán's defeat in Hungary was a major advance for Ukraine because it meant that Hungary's no longer vetoing or blocking European aid to Ukraine. So far they've gained $105 billion from Orbán's defeat in European money. And that's a couple of years of Ukrainian spending.
Major advance for Ukraine, for Europe, and for the world. But James Carville.
Just a couple of things. Before we go, I think the India-Pakistan cricket game gets a bigger TV audience than Super Bowl.
Yeah.
It's the World Cup, the India-Pakistan cricket game in the Super Bowl is 1, 2, 3. Cricket is second. I just don't know. It's a massively popular sport. It is the most successful British import ever, more than gin.
Yeah, there's still the oldest club in America continuously running is the Philadelphia, is the cricket club in Philadelphia. It's no longer got anything to do with cricket.
But, there are a lot of cricket clubs. I grew up with a Marion Cricket Club, Ed. And you're right. It had nothing to do with cricket.
Nothing
it was a
to
tennis
do with
club anyway.
Just a name.
I knew Mandelson a little bit back in the 90s. I'm sure you knew him. I'm not defending him, but he was a charming man. I mean, you could see how he was a successful person with access and governments and people wanted him around. I mean, I'm not going to his other qualities, but the guy did have a certain level of intelligence and charm and affability about him, I thought, but a little bit I knew him. And I was not surprised that he talked his way into a big role.
I agree with you. I mean, he was clearly very talented.
Yeah.
He is very talented. And there's a little bit of corner cutting how he does business. And he likes celebrities and he's right. got a little bit of that quality. But I think that was the other reason Starmer thought he would be appropriate in Trump's Washington. He kind of would fit in with them. And actually he did for a while until the Epstein files were dropped and those communications with Epstein came in.
I could see, my point is that totally out of left field that they would appoint him to that? At the time, it probably made some sense to the British government. That's my only point at the time.
I agree. No, I agree with that.
Well, but now you got to get your Irish wife and you and I and the Irish wife, we're going to Scott's and I'm buying y'all lunch, okay?
We would love that. So yes, that's a yes.
And the Irish wife and I can talk about how much we hate the monarchy. Well, we are king, but we'll see. We'll have fun though.
Fred, we did go to the garden party that the British Embassy hosted for us and 650 other really close friends of the monarchy. Went to the British Embassy garden party for Charles and Camilla on Monday, and my wife wore the brightest green dress she could find.
Hey.
Yay!
You can take a lot of Erie, but you can't take the Erie out the girl.
Well, we haven't done a tally, but I think Ed Luce not only is one of our favorite guests, but he may be our most frequent guest, James. He's right up there. And boy, we always learn something and we always love being in your company, Ed. Thank you very much.
A real delight. Thanks to both of you.
The king and the Pope. Who would have ever thunk?
Hey, James, our guest is Jim Gerstein, a Democrat. There is no better pollster in America. He also has polled extensively in Israel. Jim, let me start with a simple question. 187 days out. Assess the midterm outlook. How many House seats, or give me a range, the Democrats can win, and prospects for the Senate?
Well, first, great to see you guys. Great to be with you. I'm feeling very bullish. I feel very good about the Democratic prospects in November. We have kind of a toxic brew for the Republicans right now of an unpopular president, an economy in which people think costs are out of control and they can't pay their bills. I mean, it's very painful for people. And now they've added to this mix an unpopular war that has not been explained to the American people, that is not supported by the American people. And it just feels like shaping up into all the kinds of wave elections that we've seen in the past. It's the same sort of dynamic. So I'm feeling very good about it. I think, certainly the House is looking like we are positioned for the majority, and the Senate is looking pretty good too. It can be an ever-growing map there, actually.
Jim, let me raise one problem that no one is better versed on than you. There's a tug of war, I think, in the Democrats between their traditional support for Israel, at least most Democrats, and opposition to Benjamin Netanyahu. Journalist Joe Klein said the other day that for the first time in his memory, it's existentially uncomfortable to be Jewish in America. Politically, is that playing out in Michigan and elsewhere?
This is a very important policy issue. It's also an issue that activists are very passionate about on both sides. But it is very clear also that this is not an issue that is animating voters. And as we're looking at campaigns and we're looking at the landscape for 2026, the voters are focused, you know, very laser focused on the cost of living and who's going to make their lives better on a day-to-day basis. This issue doesn't factor into that equation, but it is part of the equation within the activist class, within the policymaking class. And I don't think, as you referenced, there are a lot of people who are uncomfortable in this discussion in the way it's the way it has played out over the past couple of years.
Jim, how have American attitudes changed toward Israel, and how have the attitudes of American Jews changed, if they have?
So I'll start with the Jewish population. American Jews have always felt a very strong attachment to Israel. It doesn't mean that it is a voting issue for them. In most cases, a candidate passes a threshold of being sufficiently supportive of Israel, and Jews then vote on a range of other issues that affect them on a day-to-day basis. That hasn't really changed, and it's a pretty easy threshold for a candidate to pass. And above all, Jews are a very liberal Democratic constituency, voting 70% plus for Democrats year after year. And any chance of them shifting is blunted by the fact that they cannot stand Donald Trump or the Republican Party. And this has been consistent for years, regardless of different political developments. The other thing I would add is that they don't like Benjamin Netanyahu for a variety of reasons. They don't like him. Part of it is his embrace of Trump and Trumpism. Part of it is his policies towards the settlements in the West Bank. And they don't, you know, it's very easy for them to say, we love Israel, we are emotionally attached to Israel, but we don't like this government and we don't support this government. And I think you see a similar pattern with less intensity, with less knowledge, with less centrality with the broader American public. We have seen public polling that shows that, yes, since the Gaza war, that support or attitudes towards Israel have become more negative. It doesn't mean that Americans oppose Israel or anything like that, but that they basically, Netanyahu has done a lot to damage Israel's reputation in the United States. And it's a problem for policymakers, I believe, as they try to square these different things.
And really around the world. He faces election this year. A year or two ago, he was politically dead after October 7th. Has he come back, and could he actually stay in power?
He has not come back, and it is fascinating to see how the gap between how much the public is against him and the perception that he can somehow come back. It's kind of a PTSD for voters in the center left in Israel that Netanyahu has always been counted out and he always comes back and all this. But what fundamentally changed was the security failure of October 7th, the biggest failure in the history of the country, followed by a failure to bring home the hostages in a timely manner, in which he was perceived as continuing the war for political survival purposes. There is an election by law that must take place by the end of October of this year. And so he keeps the biggest evidence that Netanyahu is not going to win is in the fact that he keeps postponing or keep putting off an election. He keeps waiting for something new to happen that could improve his fortunes. But he did not see a political bump after he back earlier in the year when the Iran nuclear facilities were attacked, and the perception was that their nuclear weapons program was decimated. He did not get a political bump out of that. He did not get a political bump out of a dramatic military operation against Hezbollah with the pagers blowing up. And he did not get a bump out of this latest Iran war, in which many in Israel support that war. But they do not, but he has not received a political bump. So the question is not whether or not Netanyahu will win. It's what comes after Netanyahu, and that is up in the air. There's a lot of a lot of uncertainty over who can win, who will win the election, who will form the next coalition.
For one of the world's greatest countries, it has one of the world's worst political systems. But anyway, James Carville, you know it well. Take over.
I just make a general point. I think Jim will agree with this. Support for a country, people try to conflate support for the government of a country with support for the country. You can support, as I think you certainly do, and I do too, the existence of a Jewish state in perpetuity on the Eastern Mediterranean. That does not mean that I support the policies that are just like, I think the Iranian people, probably if I knew them, I'd like most of them. That you can't conflate people with the government. I just did a point. I want to talk about American politics. I'm going to the Kentucky Derby and reminded of Wallace Wilkinson back in the 80s, who I represent, told the story of two 12-year-old skinny dipping in eastern Kentucky.
Uh-oh.
And they get out of water, and one of them gets his first erection. He tells the other kid, he said, "Stand back, son. I don't know how big this thing's going to get." Sometimes I get these polls coming over to Transom about October's election, or November's election, I'm sorry. And I don't see a bottom forming yet. I don't know. What you see a lot more than I do.
Look, we've been, you and I have been talking about this and Al for a long time about how much this wave is and how good of a situation Democrats are in. I feel like finally the rest of the world's beginning to catch up on this and pick up on this. And they're starting to see all these elections that are unfolding. And they're starting to say, oh, wow. I mean, all of a sudden you start to see these articles. Oh, the Democrats might win the Senate. All of a sudden, right? We've been talking about this for over a year. I think everything, there isn't an election result or a piece of data that's come back in the past 2+ years that have said anything other than this is a big wave building for the Democrats.
So it might come public. I just saw a Senate poll in Kansas that was actually, because I believe the telling point is by registration, because people's identity, you think of yourself as a Republican or Democrat, that can shift. But if you know you're registered Republican or registered Democrat, and the registration was about 4 or 5 points higher among Republicans than reality. And I would not take the Kansas Senate race off the map. I really would not. And this was taken by confident pollsters. You know, I'm a believer in, I want you to talk about this. Two things I always look for in a poll. If the undecided is over 10, I throw it out. It's just not, that's just not where it is. You just don't have that many undecided voters. I'm sorry. You see these polls. I mean, that's always a good test to whether you start to take something serious or not. But there's this question that people engage this conversation. You and I have, a lot of people are, where's Trump's floor? Can people say, well, it can't go below 40. Well, it can't go below 38. Well, it can't go below 36. I mean, is there some natural bottom that forms here or what?
Yeah, I don't know what the bottoming out floor is for him, but I would say that we're winning, we're outperforming by 15, 20 points in districts and states across. I mean, look at what just happened in Wisconsin Supreme Court race. We just won that by 20 points.
I had a appearance with Ryan Priebus last night, and I said, I don't think it's possible by the laws of political gravity that a Democrat could win by 20, and he was a nice guy. He said, well, there was some special circumstances there. Okay, well, you lined up. It was RBD. It's a good Democratic idea, but 20 in freaking Wisconsin?
The special circumstance is that we've got an unpopular war with an unpopular president and an economy in which people think they can't, that it's very, very difficult for them to pay their bills. So that's the special circumstance, and that's not special to Wisconsin. It's not special to Iowa, Alaska, Mississippi. It is everywhere.
Yeah. All right. Before I turn you back, I got one question. Are the Bears going to win 10 games next year?
I would be very disappointed if they win less than 12, James. I mean, this team, Caleb Williams can do anything. Didn't you see the playoffs last year?
Oh, that one throw is a throw we'll never forget, James.
It was amazing. So, yeah, I'm bullish on the Democrats and I'm bullish on the Bears.
And you're bullish on the Bears staying in Chicago?
Yes. That's a different discussion. That's very painful.
They'll be in metropolitan Chicago.
We'll come back to that. Jim, pollsters are paid to worry. I mean, you feel good. I believe everything you just said. I actually share all those views in large part because I've gleaned a lot from you. But what are your worries? They're going to try to sabotage this election. And are Democrats prepared for that?
Look, one worry just came true, and that was the Supreme Court decision on the Voting Rights Act. Right. But I think that the environment is so strong that this is something that will be able to withstand. I think we will still be able to have a majority in the House, and a good majority in the House if things continue to go the way they are and with the great candidates that we have across the country. I think we'll see what sort of reaction there is in terms of turnout among Black voters in the South in response to this ruling. But that was my worry, and it's unfortunate it happened. But I think I don't think that there's some scenario in which suddenly Donald Trump becomes a great statesman and people feel great about how he's leading the country. I just don't see that happening. And I will say, I think in this company, I have some credibility as being a worrier, as we were worried throughout the Biden presidency that he would run for reelection.
And we were right, Jim.
Recognized that this was not a good idea, and that there was a terrible misreading of why we did well in 2022. It was not because of Biden. If anything, it was in spite of Biden, and that it was because of Dobbs. And so I think that we are just in a different set of circumstances right now. Ryan's previous presidency calls them special. I called them national. I think that we have a very clear, we are in a good spot, and we're continuing to run good campaigns.
All right. Well, let me give you one more worry. James constantly says, and I think he's right, money isn't deciding elections. I do, however, remember my kid working for a North Carolina Senate candidate in 2022. And she outraised the Republican, 2.5-1. And then the last couple of weeks, Mitch McConnell and company came in and they poured a massive amount of money in, all negative. And they ended up outspending the Democrats 3-1. The Republicans, but Trump have a huge pot of money out there. Do you worry that they'll do the same thing this time?
Like, I do believe the money matters. I do think that mass communications matters, and you need money to do that. It's not the only thing out there. Obviously, we have an environment that is motivating and animating voters. But, particularly as we start to try to expand the map, particularly in a state like Texas, where it is going to cost a lot of money to run communications and, dozen plus media markets. I do think it matters, but I do take and share James' point that there are other factors that are going to give us a wind at our back, and we need, it is a factor, though, the money, and I think we can overcome it.
James?
Well, I in a North Carolina race, I know your son worked out with Sherry Beasley. The race ended up about where the polling had it. I was actually up about
a couple months. It changed a little bit once McConnell poured all that money in.
A little bit is a lot. I don't.
Yeah, yeah.
Two points you would die for, but right. I think this is some pretty strong stuff. So, Jim, who's a couple of I'm sure it'd be clients of yours, but who are some Democrats running out there that we may not have heard about for Congress that you think are doing are pretty impressive people that we should kind of keep an eye on here?
I mean, I guess you just had on is a client of ours in Texas by Polito, and you're helping him a lot, and I think that's exciting. That'd be a very exciting one.
Well, he's good.
Oh, God. He had the best thing. I love this. I would recommend it to all clients. He doesn't say, all people do not describe themselves as poor. They describe themselves as broke. And I think broke is a much better word than poor, because poor is a, well, you're born in poverty, you stay in poverty. No, you can be broke. Being broke is different than being poor. And I think that's a great thing that Bobby has come up with. I think a guy's going to win, man.
He also was great, James, on the question of ICE. Should we, abolish ICE? And he basically said, no, we should reform ICE. I think that question, abolishing ICE, is the defund the police of 2026. And Democrats that come into that are giving Republicans an opening. And boy, he didn't. He really answered that well.
Yep. I love Joe Mendoza in Arizona is fabulous. I don't know if you've had her on the show, but she's a real.
Where is she? What's her name?
Siskamani in Arizona.
Is she the former Marine Corps?
Yes.
We're going to get her on.
She was
at Paris Island, James. She probably beat up on you.
Hollywood Marine. Yeah, just give her 10 times about number and have them call. We're going to get her on right away.
Yeah. I mean, look, those are just two. I think you're going to have some interesting guests over time in some of these interesting Senate races.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's just, it's growing.
Yeah.
And I think the map is not what we thought it was at the beginning of the, of the cycle.
No. Go ahead.
One thing you said about money and what James, you said about undecided voters in primaries, you can expect a lot of undecided voters, until people get to know who they are. And money will make a difference in a lot of those primaries. But James, you're right. That so much of this is set by the environment. So much is set by the antagonism towards the failures of the Republicans.
The biggest determinative in how you're going to do is D versus R after you name. But I hate to say that. That's where it is, man. All right, Jim, we love having you on. We'll have you back. You and Ed Luce might be our favorite. We don't want to do just a show with y'all every week. It's up to me. But back to you, Al.
Well, I want to second that. And James not only is going to have a bunch of winning candidates this year, but talked earlier, his kid went to Michigan a couple of years ago, and all they did was win a national football and a national basketball championship.
Bring him to LSU. Shit, we hate him.
So not a bad thing, Jim Gerstein. You're a terrific guest. Let's stay in touch, okay?
Absolutely.
Thank you for having me.
Now for the outrage of the week. You know, it was less than a decade ago that Utah Senator Mike Lee had a conservative conscience. I really agree with him, but he was principled like his father, a former U.S. Solicitor General. In 2016, he was repulsed by Trump. But unlike his Utah colleague, Mitt Romney, Lee decided his political fortunes were better with Trump, so he put his political conscience in a blind trust. A small example. After the Saturday night shooting at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, dangers were avoided as the shooter never really got in the ballroom. But on Sunday, facts, as the Justice Department said, were still being gathered. We knew the basic facts of who he was, what he did, but there were lots of other things. Barack Obama put out a statement rejecting violence, praising the courage and devotion of the Secret Service, while saying some more facts will emerge. It's really what Justice said. But Lee and other MAGA types blasted Obama, who they accused of hiding the facts. He was doing no such thing, merely putting out a statement condemning violence and commending the brave men and women of the Secret Service. The former Lee would have commended Obama. The new Lee just wants to please his leader.
Okay, so I want to tip my hat to one of my favorite people in my life in American politics, a guy that I don't have on the surface very much in common with. I certainly don't have the same sexual taste, different part of the country, different upbringing, different everything. But I don't know, be hard pressed to think of three people I admire more in my career in American politics than Barney Frank. And Barney's 87, and inevitably he's entering a hospice, and the runway at the end of his life is in sight. But his advice to Democrats was very very wise, very Borneo-esque, that you keep the goal in mind. You're trying to help people. You don't overreach. You do things that you need to do. And I just thought it was such wisdom from such a wise guy, or not a wise guy in the sense wise guy.
A wise man. A wise man.
Yeah, I should have said a wise man. And contrast this with these blooming idiots at Working Family Party. Look up these dotes and look at, and there's not a single person that identifies with them that lives more than 15 miles away from salt water. And I don't know where these people come from. I have always suspected, I have no proof. I wish some competent journalist would do a deep dig into their funding. And I wouldn't be surprised if you found a lot of right-wing donors giving money to these idiots like Working Families Party, talking about guarantees and the stupidity that they have. And I just think that Barney Frank at 87 years old represents the future and the success of the Democratic Party. And, you know, sometimes I know we have this youth movement and everybody likes, as do I, am also fired up about Jim Tallarico and the youth movement there. But, you know, sometimes wisdom comes down from older people. And Barney, let this old Cajun boy take his hat off to a great Massachusetts.
Well, I would take my hat. I first met Barney in 1967 and have known him very well. James, I wrote him today to see if there's any chance that he's physically up. He is in hospice, physically up to doing an interview with us to talk about his book. If he is, we'll do it in a minute. We'll do it at 3 a.m. if we have to.
But there's wisdom, because, there's wisdom, that man.
He is one of the great Americans of the last 60 years. He's incredible. Barney, we're thinking about you. We care about you. We admire you immensely. Well, I share everything James said.
Absolutely.
Hey, James, now our listener questions. We start off with Mark in Memphis, Tennessee, and Jeff in Winfield, Kansas. Both asked the basic same question. Trump has ruined our economy. It's in shambles, and our reputation in the world is worse. Why can't the Democrats run a national campaign for the House in 2026?
Well, I run a national campaign. Like on what? On a Democratic platform or run a national campaign against Trump? I mean, this race is going to be totally nationalized. This is not going to be an election that's going to be determined by potholes, and it's not going to be determined by things. It is by and large going to be determined by your attitude about Trump, which is massively negative now and getting more negative, by the way. So I would tell my friends that I don't think we need it right now. That there's a time and a place for it. But right now, my advice to Democrats is don't just do nothing. Stand there. I mean, I'm looking at polling coming in. And my sense is that it's going to get better. And I think this economy is, I don't see anything that tells me it's getting any better. But I am not an advocate of the Democrats coming out with a massive message between now and November.
With a platform or anything. I agree. John in Junction City, California says, as time passes, we see the Trump administration and Trump himself instigating lawsuit after lawsuit, the vast majority of which fail. Are those my tax dollars being flushed down the toilet? Man, you got it, John. You betcha they are. And I hope someone out there, some Democratic congressman, start tallying up the tab here. Of all the money spent on cases that were thrown out by judges or thrown out by grand juries, all the money that Trump is wasting on his retribution campaign and that his Justice Department is acquiescing in. That's a good point you raise.
It's a really good point. And by the way, you're paying for the Supreme Court also, which is not any better than his stupid lawsuits. And it's a shame, but yes, it's costing you money and they're wasting your money and they're not giving you fairness. They're not giving you justice. They're not giving you democracy. They're not giving you anything else. And I'm sorry, this is the state of affairs in the United States today, but trust me, I think it's going to get better.
Yeah, I do too. David in Lawrence, Kansas, the home of the Jayhawks. It says, James counsels Democrats to let Trump be Trump because you can't stop a man who insists on digging his own grave. That being the case, he asked specifically, how do you think Trump's targeting of Cassidy Hutchinson, the former White House aide who testified before the January 6th committee, how's that going to go?
Well, I don't think that it's going to matter. I mean, that's just part of a larger mosaic of all of the stupid things that Trump does. And she seemed like an intelligent, kind of put together young woman. And he's just petty and vile. And I'm sure Ms. Hutchinson understands that, is not surprised by any of this.
Yeah. Victor in Portland, Oregon. That's a city. I love Portland, Oregon. I haven't been there in a while. I gotta find some way to get back. Victor asks, is it in Russia's interest to keep the Iran war going as long as possible? Victor, you bet it is. And it's in China's interest, too. The more America is diverted economically, militarily, diplomatically, the better it is for the greater threats, which are China and Russia. This is, you know, this is really a little bit like the Vietnam War. The Russians loved the Vietnam War because that's where all of America's energies were going. And this is every day this war goes on is a good day for Vladimir Putin and the Chinese.
I 100% agree, but the other war that's going on that's not good for Vladimir Putin is the Ukraine war. And apparently,
that's for sure.
Things are getting a little, I mean, you don't know what you get out of there or what you read, but what you see. You see the May Day parade, that they're having all of their equipment stuck with the Ukrainians. And the Ukrainians have now become the best drone manufacturers in the world.
The Israelis are getting drones from the Ukrainians.
Right. And the fact that Ukraine is fighting the Russians to not make a standstill, or maybe slightly better than a standstill. And the fact that we're stuck in the mud in Iran is embarrassing, to say the least, to American prestige and American power. It's just, people should be totally outraged by this whole thing. It's sad. It's disgusting. It's a waste of everything. And I suspect a big win out of all of this is Xi in China. But
I do too.
It looks like he's doing pretty good.
Pete in Raleigh, North Carolina says there's a lot of gloom and doom about the Electoral College after the 2030 census. How can Democrats be fleeing the Rust Belt at the same time Republican strongholds like Texas and Florida are going to be getting stronger as far as the Electoral College and representation in the House? Those Democrats are going somewhere. What should the Democrats do?
So this is something I don't know, Sam, maybe we could get a target a demographer on here. So if people are moving from blue states to red states, well, how do we know they're not Democrats that are moving too? A lot of people that move are educated.
Right.
Okay, a lot of people that move are females. So how do we know we're not creating more Democrats in places like Florida or Texas or Georgia or Arizona? I mean, you've had massive in-migration to a state like Arizona, and at the same time, you've had a strengthening of the Democratic Party. But how are we so certain that once somebody is a Democrat in New York and they move to Florida, does that make them a Republican? I don't think so. Once somebody is a Democrat in California, if they move to Texas, does that make them a Republican? I don't think so. So I'm not totally sure. I don't see how in the short term it benefits us, but I think all these assumptions are going to be laid on their head come November. I think we're just assuming too much. But Ms. Wright, this migration is happening at some level. It will reorient the Electoral College map. But, you know, look at North Carolina.
Well, there's a simple answer, James. Compete in Florida and Texas.
Yeah.
You know, get candidates who can win in those places. Absolutely. I agree. On that line, Will in Boise, Idaho says, do political systems in certain states become effectively locked in, or can they still shift quickly? There can be huge changes. Just look over the last 30 years. New Jersey and California used to be a predominantly Republican states. West Virginia and Arkansas were Democratic strongholds. It changes. Population patterns change. And Florida used to be competitive. It hasn't been. It can be again.
I can't tell you how much I agree with you. I hate to say I agree with you all the time. I like a little tension to show.
I don't mind
First
that.
Of all, there's political Presbyterians. That everything, and everybody that wrote a story after the 2024 election about the under 30 vote, and about the Hispanic vote, and about the younger males, is going to look like fucking idiots. And I got news for you. If you are a commentator or a columnist or anything like that, and you said, we're saying that in late 2024, early 2025, clean up, because you're going to look like a fool. And I know people that are chronicling all of these stories about how the Democrats lost the Hispanics and lost the youth vote, and they're going to be turned on their head, and you're going to look like a fool. So memo to the observationist and the political Presbyterians in the commentariat, you better get your act straight before November, because you're going to look like an idiot.
Yep. Final question comes from Drew in Cleveland, Ohio. It looks like Alito and Thomas are refusing to retire before the midterms. If Democrats get the Senate, will they prevent a vote until after Trump is out? Can they keep the Senate that long?
Yes.
Yeah, James, I agree. They will prevent a vote. I'm skeptical that Alito is not going to retire. I think Alito will.
But if that you go to post and a Democrat hit, by the way, I'm willing to, I know I've been wrong about a lot of things, like, I don't think the Senate's going to be close. I honestly don't, man. I'm seeing polls, and things change, but it's just as likely that things stay the same or get worse. If they stay the same, the Democrats go in the Senate, and it's not going to be close. It's not going to be 51 seats, which they have to have, because Fetterman's going to switch. If the Democrats win at 51-49, I guarantee you John Fetterman is going to switch.
Yeah. James, final thing, we love these questions. And the hardest thing of all is when James and I have to choose which, six or seven and the 10 or 15 we don't use. But please keep them coming. Again, we love these questions. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at PolitiCon. Following this episode, we really appreciate it if you check out the link to our sponsor, Superpower, in our episode show notes. We deeply thank you for supporting them, because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And check out the Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. You can also find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast site. And remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.